Produced at CFIS-FM in Prince George, Health First is available across Canada through the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
Well, our guest in this half hour is Dr. Margaret Goodman. She is a Las Vegas neurologist, and she's written a book called Death in Vegas, which is Rocky meets Aaron Brockovich, page-turner. Dr. Goodman, tell us a little bit about you founded VADA, the Voluntary Anti-Doping Association. Tell us a little bit about that and why you thought that there was a need for that at the time.
You know, I'm really glad that you asked about that. There's so much discussion about drug testing in preparation for the big fight that's happening in Las Vegas in a couple months between Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. And we, our group, has tested Pacquiao twice. But, you know, the way, and it's the same thing in Canada. And by the way, I was born in Toronto. But just to throw that in, but there. Boxing and mixed martial arts are state-regulated or province-regulated. For example, the Ontario Commission does their own thing as opposed to the Edmonton Commission, etc. And one of the problems with that is there's no uniformity. You know, these organizations or these different state commissions, province commissions, will discuss things with one another. They'll meet a yearly with the Association of Boxing Commissions, which oversees both sports, but they don't have to do things. They create their own rules, so to speak. And so even though drug testing is done through the NFL, through the NHL, in Major League Baseball, which to me is inadequate as it is, but in boxing and MMA, comparatively, there's very little done. And when you think about it, athletes that are getting hit in the head essentially for a living, and they're not being tested for performance-enhancing drugs, not nearly as much as in cycling or even in thoroughbred racing, you can see the importance in expanding testing. When I was with the state of Nevada, we did do testing on fighters after a fight, but it didn't really involve performance-enhancing drugs until around, I think around 2001, when we added a panel for anabolic steroids. But there's so many other things besides basic anabolic steroids that a fighter would take. So I one of the reasons I left the commission at the time when I did was to speak out on a lot of these issues related to safety. And so I kept talking about, you know, as much as I could, and I even wrote for a boxing magazine called The Ring for several years about the problem of performance-enhancing drugs. And people go, oh, fighters wouldn't use these things, blah, blah, blah. Well, every athlete will use these things. I mean, if you look at even amateur sports, they're prevalent. And so I created the organization called the Voluntary Anti-Doping Association, like you said, a nonprofit, to bring attention to the need for to expanding testing within commissions, but also to expand the knowledge for clean sport, even with the media. And so what we do allow is fighters themselves can volunteer to our organization to be tested, which no other professional organization has such an entity where an athlete can volunteer. That doesn't happen in baseball, it doesn't happen in football, it doesn't happen in hockey or soccer or cycling, where they can volunteer to undergo a rigorous testing program. And our program, we use only World Anti-Doping Agency accredited labs, certified doping collection officers, so it is extremely stringent, and in some respects it's stringent to most of the testing that goes on now in other sports. And so as we've been around, it's really prompted a lot of other organizations, including boxing commissions, athletic commissions, to expand their own testing. So we've kind of been a nasty gnat in their ear, so to speak. So I'm kind of proud of that. Like I said, we do have fighters that volunteer to us. You know, this kind of testing is costly. I mean, it is. I mean, if you look at the amount of money that's spent by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency in testing Olympic-level athletes, I mean, it's millions and millions of dollars, and they get money from the federal government to conduct their program per year. So it's hard for fighters, and on most instances, the fighters that volunteer to us are the higher-profile fighters like a Manny Pacquiao. But it really has made a dent in the sport as far as bringing the attention to it.
That was my question. Who's going to pay for that? Who is paying for these tests?
So
is it the fighter himself?
Yeah, so far it's either been the promoter. We're now testing fighters. There's a big fight, a pretty big fight that's taking place in Verona, New York on HBO on April 18th, and it's between two fighters, I can't remember if he's from Uzbekistan, a fighter from that part of the world by the name of Ruslan Provodnikov, who's fighting an Argentinian fighter by the name of Lucas Matisse. And basically, one fighter's camp has opted to pay for the testing, mainly because the other camp didn't want to do it. But often we'll have the promoter will pay for the testing. When we tested Manny Pacquiao, when he fought in Macau twice, we tested both he and his opponent, and the promoter Top Rank paid for the testing. I think for the Manny Pacquiao fight, I think the fighters are paying, or it might even be Floyd Mayweather paying for that testing. So it depends. Also, because we're a nonprofit, other individuals have donated to pay for the testing because they believe in clean sport. We'd obviously like to have other people donate. It's a write-off. So just, and also can be written off as a business expense if they're in the field of boxing or mixed martial arts. We've had mixed martial artists themselves. George St. Pierre, who's from Montreal, very famous MMA fighter, he paid for his own testing and even volunteered to pay for his opponent who didn't want to opt for the testing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I agree with you. It's very costly, especially the kind of testing that we do. You know, for example, when we tested Manny Pacquiao, he was training in the Philippines. So we sent a collection officer over to the Philippines to collect his blood and urine, and it was actually brought back to the UCLA WADA-accredited lab. So it's the collection costs that are much more expensive than the actual testing itself, although the testing can be costly as well.
Margaret, you talk about drug testing and drug abuse, as one way that people are trying to get advantage. What are some of the other areas of corruption in these sports, and how are they affecting athletes?
You know, one of the areas that, and I it's a kind of a strong word to say it's corruption, but let's say term it as maybe lack of regulation or inadequate regulations, because of the fact that the way the sport is regulated, different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, a promoter is able to pick jurisdiction shop. In other words, they can take a fighter to a jurisdiction in the United States or maybe even Canada or Mexico or even further internationally where the restrictions on those athletes are less, where they may not undergo any drug testing at all, where they may only need to have a yearly physical before they step in the ring. And so if we want to be really negative, that if someone knew that a fighter had a pre-existing problem or even a communicable disease where there isn't stringent testing for HIV or hepatitis, they might take them to a jurisdiction where they know the tests aren't as strict, where they don't have to undergo those kinds of blood tests or even a brain scan to determine if they're eligible to compete. And so that can happen. Another way that I've seen this in Olympic level sports is this has been a big issue as far as match fixing, where, I was looking at this when I watched the last Olympics, where people were complaining that a volleyball team was matched up with another volleyball team, or a ping pong team was matched up with another, table tennis rather, was matched up with somebody else. And how does that happen? Because if you're matched up with somebody that you know you can beat, your chances of winning are that greater. And so that often happens, too, where if a commission isn't educated enough, strong enough to say, I won't allow this certain match to take place with one fighter that's overmatched against another, that can be a problem. And so, that's what you see. People say, is boxing ever fixed? Well, I don't think that happens. I think that would be extremely, extremely rare. But what can happen is a fighter that's overmatched is matched against somebody who's much stronger with greater experience. And so that can be where you can kind of predict an outcome.
If you had kids and they wanted to get involved in some of these sports, whether it's mixed martial arts or boxing or football, basketball, any of those other ones you talked about, what would be your recommendations for considering the safety, long-run safety of these children?
I would think that one thing that I see all the time that upsets me is parents will, so to speak, hand their child off to somebody to train them. And this goes for even football. I mean, you really have to be there. You have to see what your child is undergoing. You have to have input. And you have to have really done your homework to make sure that the trainer, the person, or the coach that's working with your child is educated enough. Because as it goes in boxing and MMA, you know, somebody can just hang a towel over their shoulder and call themselves a trainer. And they may not have the expertise. You know, one thing that I see that happens all too often when young teens will start in either boxing or MMA or other sports where there's contact is they're maybe not examined before they go into the sport. You know, so I would want my child to have had an MRI, have had a good physical, and make sure that the coach or whoever the trainer is really trained enough themselves to know if someone suffered a concussion. I often see that, especially in boxing, that youngsters are put in weight classes where they don't belong, you know, and here you have their growing body developing not just their brain but also their body, and they're put in a weight class where they're put in a weight class that's too low, they're asked to lose weight. You know, most fighters, kind of like in a jockey situation, you know, jockeys have to weigh in before they ride the horse and then after, etc. And often they develop eating disorders, and eating disorders lead to performance enhancing drug use by just being in the wrong weight class, being out of shape, or ballooning in and out of weights, you know, depending on when you're competing. And so weight tends to be a huge problem in a lot of these sports. And so you have, I've seen this with a friend of mine, her son, who's 14 years of age, strong athletic abilities, was asked to compete in junior high wrestling. And the coach saw him wrestle somebody in his weight class, his own, you know, walk-around weight. And the kid was so good, the coach came to him the next week and said, you know, I want you in this bigger weight class, because you're so strong, and the kid got really beat badly. And I've seen the converse happen, where a kid was told to lose weight. You know, you shouldn't have a 14-year-old kid on a diet. I mean, that just doesn't make sense, especially if they're in good shape already, you know, and they don't have a problem with obesity. And so, I mean, you just see those things, and I think it starts when they're really young.
Dr. Goodman, we got a couple minutes left, and I'm wondering if you can just tell readers about your book itself and why they should pick it up.
Well, I think that when I set out to write this book, I wrote a lot of it about the sport of boxing, but it's really a love story. It's a fun read. It's got some humor in it, and bottom line is it's about a female neurologist, starts off in the city of Chicago. She's estranged from her family and suddenly finds out that her brother, who's a professional fighter, was injured in a high-profile boxing match. So to reconnect with her family, she travels to Las Vegas, mostly out of guilt, and finds out that her brother may not have been injured from the fight specifically. So she kind of infiltrates the sport as a ring physician, something that she never did, never even had a desire to, and meets the love of her life, but also learns a great deal about the sport, the fighters, the politics involved in how fights are made, the politics of what goes on in the city of Las Vegas, and finds herself, that, you know, all of the inadequacies and things that she didn't do for herself in her life, she learns by becoming a part of this sport and a part of the life here in Las Vegas.
Sounds fast, like a fascinating book. I think I'm going to pick it up, and I'm going to look forward to the movie as well, Death in Vegas.
Sounds good, and I pictured George Clooney as the male character and perhaps Jessica Chastain as the female.
It's going to be awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Goodman.
I appreciate your time. Thanks again.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Charles Francis, author of Mindful Meditation Made Simple.